Welcome to another episode of Million Dollar Stories, where we get to interview authors from all over the world. As you know, we talk a lot about financial literacy, and I think the future is either very scary or very exciting, depending on how well you are prepared. And I see the future as pretty exciting for the everyday entrepreneur, if you can capitalize on what's coming your way, specifically such things as the blockchain. And many of you might not know what it is or how to use it, but it probably will be part of your lexicon more and more as time goes on. And that's why we have this guest who seems to be an expert in this world. So the book that he wrote is called Move Over Brokers, Here Comes the Blockchain. And the author today is, he goes by Dr. Care Finlow Bates. He just goes by Care Finlow Bates for short, and it is an honor to have you on the Million Dollar Stories podcast, sir.
Well, thank you. I'm really happy to be here.
Well, let's start off with the genesis of this book. I think a lot of people think that crypto is a scam, and I think a lot of people think that it's going to come and go, and not many people trust it. But even if you don't understand crypto or don't believe in it, there is something that is tied to it very well, and that's the blockchain. And so if you could maybe give us the genesis of why you wrote this book and maybe a little bit of your background.
Right. Okay. Well, that's quite a broad question. We have to go back to 2010 or 2011, which is when I was a test engineering manager in a software company. And someone said, you like cryptography and computer security, and there's this thing called Bitcoin. Maybe you'd like to have a look at it. And I did. And it was technically really interesting. I was completely clueless about entrepreneurship and finance at that point, like the average software engineer is. You know, money's the stuff you use to go and buy beer at the bar and bread at the supermarket. So I didn't really pick up on the financial significance at that point. I was just thinking the technology behind this is really cool. I mean, it's peer-to-peer networking, this new kind of database, and consensus systems. It all looked fascinating. So then we move on about 5 years, and the company laid a whole bunch of us off. I live in Finland, although I'm English, and I had to find something to do. And I thought, well, I've had 20 years of testing all sorts of software. Maybe it's time to look at blockchain commercially and actually maybe start a business doing something about it. The business failed. So like most people going into a startup for the first time, especially if you're technically minded and you go in as a CEO who's actually really a techie, it's surprisingly hard to succeed. I didn't know the difference between marketing and sales, for example. Right.
Yeah. I always see that the people who are very smart, who know the product in and out, might not really enjoy the marketing world as much. And it's not the greatest product that wins. Usually it's the greatest marketer. And there is sort of a learning curve that comes along with it.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, engineers believe that statement, you know, build it and they will come, the sort of field of dreams slogan. And it's a real shock if you're a technical person when you wake up one day and you realize that you built it and there's nobody there. So that's what happened with the company. And at the same time, I was going through this journey of learning about marketing and sales. So I wouldn't say I'm an expert at it, but at least I now know what it is. And, you know, I've actually pulled off a few minorly successful marketing stunts in the process. And I thought I'll write a book because everybody has at least one good book inside them. And I thought I really wanted to communicate what this technology behind Bitcoin is, the blockchain, and why blockchain and Bitcoin are significant. And this was, I think it was 2018 when I decided I wanted to do that. And at that point, I wasn't even 100% convinced myself. I did wake up in the middle of the night thinking, why have I hitched my horse to this cart called blockchain? There's a lot of respected and eminent institutions and people out there who are deriding it, calling it rat poison squared, saying that it's just for criminals. And I'm here. I'm not a criminal. I'm just a guy with a test engineering background. What have I missed? And in fact, in the process of writing the book, so for those of you watching, that's the cover. I thought, you know, maybe I can actually discover more about it myself. And it worked. I gave myself an economics education, the technology I understand. Now I understand the economics too. And writing a book is a fantastic journey when it comes to learning about marketing sales.
100%.
I can't really think of anything better if you're trying to teach yourself than trying to sell a book, because man, it's hard.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's almost as if you become more of an authoritative figure in that field, specifically because you have to communicate it in such a way mm-hmm. that the average person will understand. And by writing a book, it helps you maybe become a better communicator. And the byproduct of that is just unbelievable. So I'm with you. I preach that every day. So I looked into this, and before this podcast, I just went into the basics of, you know, how did the blockchain even get started? And I just pulled this up. The early concepts of blockchain started in the year 1991. Now think about this. Can you imagine even understanding what blockchain technology was in 1991? Like the internet was just starting to come to life. But the foundational concept of blockchain was described in 1991 by Stuart Haber and Scott Stornetta. They proposed a system to create tamper-proof documents using a chain of blocks secured by cryptography. This idea was developed further by others, such as the incorporation of Hashtree or Merkle tree. Never heard of that. For efficient and secure verification of large data sets. And then move forward to 2009, Satoshi Nakamoto.
Satoshi Nakamoto, yeah.
Puts together this idea, and nobody really knows who Satoshi is, right? So this is another interesting piece to this. Creates the Bitcoin that's run off of the blockchain. And then all of a sudden, blockchain and Bitcoin become part of our lexicon from that day forward. So maybe if you can go back to 2009, 2011, whenever you started to get involved, I guess it was so new, probably still very, you know, most people don't even trust it to this day, but people thought that it was just a dream at that point. So what made you fall in love with it? Was it just the fact that it was so universal, so scalable, and you were onto something?
Well, for me, it was that the components that it uses and the hash link list, the tamper-proof database using cryptography to secure it is actually only one part of it. So that's just a way of adding data to a sort of pile of data in such a way that you can't alter the earlier bits. So that's important, the tamper-proof ledger, right? I mean, this is an accountant's dream, unless there are accountants for a criminal syndicate, is having knowing that once you put something in there, you can't delete it afterwards. You can put an edit in later saying, actually, the thing we had in earlier was wrong, or would like to correct it. But you can't change the past in a tamper-proof ledger. So that's the kind of first thing you need if you're going to keep track of who owns what.
Right.
Is a ledger. And we've had this. So when you say it started in sort of 1991, I mean, we can go back to the Italian Renaissance and the arrival of, so double entry bookkeeping, accounting. I mean, you could say it started then. You could actually say it started in ancient Sumeria, where they had clay tablets and they were recording who put how much grain in the storage silos so that they could then later come along and take it out again. I mean, now we're going back to, you know, 1000 BC. It's really hard to say when something starts, right? So that the second thing is something called asymmetric key cryptography, which is really hard to pronounce. And it's actually surprisingly tricky to explain. It came about in the 70s. It was discovered by, that would be the RSA guys, I guess. There are people like Diffie-Hellman and Rivest and Shamir and Adelman and people like that. They were working in the 70s, big breakthroughs in cryptography. At the same time, there were people working in British intelligence who were also coming up with this stuff. They had a whole history of cryptographical development since the Second World War. They weren't allowed to publish, so they don't get their names stuck on the discovery. But it was researchers in American universities who published the first stuff. And this asymmetric key cryptography is this private key, public key thing you may or may not have heard of. So you've got a public key that you can give to anybody, and you have a private key that you can use to sign stuff. And it's asymmetric because you have these two keys. And what you're doing with that is, it's like, I'm the only person with the private key who can sign things, and everybody else can verify with my public key that the signature is valid. So it's kind of tricky, but it's required because it's what gives you an identity on the blockchain. And the great thing is, you can create the identity yourself. You can create your own private key. It's just picking a large random number. And then you can use the software to generate the public key. And the public key is kind of, that's the entry in the ledger that says who you are. And then the other entry is how much you own. So that's another part. Then there's peer-to-peer networks, which is how all these computers discover each other. And again, I mean, you've probably heard of Napster.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Yeah. Sharing music in a decentralized manner. There's lots of work that's been done on how you can have computers set up so they all find each other and talk to each other over the network without you having to go to a central authority and say, you know, give me the information. And those bits combined together give you a ledger that says who owns what. That the person who is registered as the owner is the only one who can make a change to the entries about them and the stuff they own. And it's decentralized, so you don't have a MasterCard or a Visa or something like that sitting in the middle that you have to rely on to transmit all the transactions to the right parties and pay them a cut, or have them even censor you. Say, like, no, we're not allowing you to have a credit card, or we're not going to allow you to buy the stuff that you want to buy with your credit card because we are opposed to the products that you're trying to get hold of.
And I want to touch on that real quick. How is it so decentralized? Because I get that question all the time, and I just say there are servers all over the world that pretty much keep track of all this, so it's impossible to wipe away data. But that's all I really know. So before I answer, before you answer that question, I'd love for you to answer, why does the cover of the book feature a strawberry with a razor blade? I was curious about that from the very beginning. So can you answer that first?
Yeah. Well, actually, in the book, I explain the stuff a lot better than I'm doing here in this podcast, because I'm thinking technically and I should be thinking analogies. The book uses punk rock as an analogy for Bitcoin and blockchain. So, and the reason that I think the analogy works is that in the finance world, we have all these incumbents, these central authorities who've been around for some of them hundreds of years, you know, Goldman Sachs and JP Morgan and banks like that. And then along comes blockchain and Bitcoin, and it sort of says, we're throwing that all out. We're going to do it ourselves. And that's the punk rock music ethos. Is
the three chords. I see that playing in the band, three chords. I love when you said,
yeah,
because I'm a three chord bandit. That's all I know on the guitar.
All right. Okay. Well, it's a really good way to start music, actually, because it gives you the passion. And then over time, you can build up or just enjoy punk rock for what it is. So so in the 70s, when you had these punk rock bands that came along in the US and New York in particular, I think CBGB's was the like the sort of central venue, and we had a whole bunch over in the UK, especially in London. They kind of rejected the music labels and the record companies and prog rock and synthesizers and everything being expensive and having to have expensive equipment and recording studios, and said, we're just going to do it ourselves. And it was, they could do that for a whole bunch of reasons, which I actually talk about in the book. And then I look at the same thing that was happening in blockchain, that we had enough pieces that we could put them together and people could write their own software, release it in using the open source software model, find each other to develop it without needing a company and a project manager to organize the whole thing. So that was kind of unique. You needed that in place. The technical stuff was all there, and there were news groups that anybody could join where you could discuss these things. I mean, there's a news group for everything. So if you happen to be a fan of, I don't know, Sphinx cats or, you know, Roman gods or something like that, well, there's also news groups out there for people who actually want to talk about mathematics and cryptography and computer software. It's not all just looking at pictures of kittens and sharing memes on the internet. Some people do serious work there. So, so there was that kind of ability to share stuff. And then, yeah, all those individual computer components that I mentioned. So it was a kind of matter of sticking it together with Lego, But it's really complicated Lego where you can't immediately see how it fits together. And the funny thing is the result, it wasn't clear to everybody at the time the significance of it. I mean, I remember sort of 2012, 2013, 2015 having endless debates about, well, what's the key thing about blockchain? And we've kind of settled now on this idea of true ownership and censorship resistance. And that was what I was talking about with the credit cards companies being able to block your purchase.
Which is why I'm so excited about it, right? It does give power back to the people. And I'm always a little bit weary about how the government can get involved and really throw things off. But this is the one way of, you know, controlling your destiny. And it seems like you're kind of bypassing the government. Now, how well is the government or governments going to take this? I don't know. But it seems to be the only thing that I can think of where you now can do business with from person to person in different parts of the world instantly without having to involve banks, right? That's huge. Yep. And you're able to have the speed of it is unheard of. So I'm looking at this as such a blessing. Is there anything that people should be worried about if they do get involved with this? I mean, is there some things that you got to, you know, maybe keep close to your vest? Because in my opinion, if you have crypto, if you have any type of NFTs, every piece of that is on the blockchain, which means it's pretty much open source. It's open record. Everybody can see that. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the first thing is that unless there are some privacy coins out there that use really complicated cryptographic concepts to hide stuff. But things like Bitcoin, it's transparent. You can see the transactions. You may not know who is transacting with who. It's like you can see the bank account numbers and you can see the amount of money moving from one account number to the other. You don't necessarily know who owns the account, though. So actually, it's beneficial to law enforcement if they're trying to track down criminal activity because the record's there forever. If you are a criminal and you have a transaction, it's there. And if the the authorities work out that that was a criminal transaction, it may take a year, 5 years, 10 years, but at some point, if you slip up and you are able to be traced back to that address, then they've got you. The evidence is there on the blockchain. You can't delete it. Whereas if you hand over a suitcase of $100 bills, you know, in a warehouse by the docks, if there's no security cameras there, it's done. The transaction, it's kind of, the transaction's taken place. There's no record of it anymore. So it's not fantastic for privacy in that respect, but what it does give you is this control. And that's where you get the first risk, which is if you are genuinely going to use crypto yourself and not use a custodial wallet, not get a third party to look after it for you, then you have to look after it yourself. And it's the same risk as having a suitcase full of gold bars under your bed, right?
Yep.
You are actually owning that yourself the way that if you went out and bought $100,000 worth of gold, which is actually surprisingly portable. It's only like, what would it be, a couple of kilos? So it's like a bag of flour weight or you know, a couple of quarts of milk or something. You would have to look after that yourself. Normally, you would go and put it in a safe, right? With crypto, you can do that. There are custodians that you can hand it to who will look after it for you. Or you can take the option to self-custody. And that's the true ownership, but it comes with a responsibility.
Is the reason why, I think the number one reason, in my opinion, the reason why we don't trust crypto at this point is because it's so volatile, right? Mm-hmm. And so if we can't guarantee that whatever we have in our hands is going to be at least the same value tomorrow, we kind of discount it. And we say, oh, there's no guarantees. We're just so early in the game. I mean, I've always said this, and maybe I'm wrong, but we're going to see some of the benefit in this generation, but it's really going to be the kids and the grandkids that are going to see the true benefit of this, in my opinion. Maybe I'm wrong, but it's going to be something that's going to be part of our everyday life, and we're just at the very, very beginning. Therefore, it's like you have to train a society on this new technology, and yes, it's happening very fast, but will we see the true benefit of people buying houses on the blockchain? Are we going to see people buying cars on the blockchain and using crypto to do so? And it's going to be quite frequent throughout the day.
I I try to avoid making predictions, especially ones about the future. But I'd like to think that it's going to be around in some way. I think it's a leap forward. At the moment, really, we've only seen blockchain applied in sort of thoroughly to finance and to money.
Yeah.
And it's still kind of being worked out. What does this mean? And it's only 15 years old.
Yeah.
When you think about how much money has been put into it in that period of time, and I find it staggering. I remember I wrote in a blog post in 2013, imagine if one day a Bitcoin is worth $10,000, wouldn't that be something? And you know, it's now worth seven times that. Yeah.
I mean, yeah. What is it? Is it 70,000? I sold 65 last 65, week.
65, 758, according to my little thing. I don't know if you can see it. So called a nerd miner. It shows the price and it's very ineffectively trying to mine Bitcoin. It'll find one when the universe has suffered a heat death. It's not poor, but it's a fun little thing.
The adoption of crypto. So, and guys, if you're out there and you're trying to put it all together, if you're adopting crypto, if you're in the NFTs, it's on the blockchain. So what I've realized, and maybe it's even crazier now, but a year ago, I saw that the adoption of crypto was actually faster than the adoption of like the internet. So people thought back in 1995 when they heard the word email, oh, that's a fad, right? I remember seeing interviews that the email is going to come and go. What a fad that is. Well, look what happened, right? The adoption of internet was slower than the adoption of crypto. So it is getting crazier and crazier. And I'm assuming this is such a benefit to the world because now we have another option, right? We don't have to worry about banks as much. So I think it's happening. We're just not seeing it maybe as fast as we really want. Like you said, it's 15 years old. It's not that old.
Yeah. And also, you know, for us in the Western world, if you're in America or Finland or the UK or Germany, we've got good banking systems. We have a relatively stable currency. Most people have access to the financial system. And so it's very easy for us, for skeptics in those kind of countries, to go, well, what's the big fuss about? I can pay for stuff with my credit card. I can, you know, if I need money, I've got a bank account, I can get hold of it. You forget that most of the people out there don't have that luxury. There are plenty of people who aren't banked, and there are plenty of people who are banked in countries where there is extreme censorship. And the fact is, even in our supposedly enlightened democratic nations, we still see abuses of power by financial institutions, and they can really cripple you. And it may be something as simple as your credit card company not allowing you to buy Bitcoin, which has happened in the US. It can be your government freezing your bank account because you're involved in a protest that they disapprove of.
Which just happened not too long ago in Canada, am I right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, I'm not... I don't follow the Canadian news in detail. And of course, there's polarized accounts as to what was going on there. But I can well believe that a government may say, well, this is a national emergency and we have this tool and we're going to use it. And the protesters saying, well, this is a legitimate protest. I'm sorry that it's cluttering up your streets, but we feel this angry about it. And it's one of the things that we kind of believe we should be allowed to do in a democratic country, which is actually go in the streets and wave placards around and say, this has got to change. And I was a student in the late 80s and early 90s, and there were a lot of protests going on in the UK at that time. We were coming to the end of the Thatcher years, and we all felt that, you know, this is our right. We as long as we're not engaging in looting or violence, then we should be allowed to get to go to the streets and wave placards and demand that the government changes its policies. The big one in the early 90s was the poll tax in the UK. They changed the taxation system and it hit the poor relatively hard and students. And we were allowed to protest. I'm not so sure that that kind of thing can go on in the same way anymore. There's been a lot of clamping down on this. And the fact that the financial system can be used as a weapon against protesters in the same way that the police force got turned into an internal private army to control protests, I think is really worrying. So it's nice to know that there is an alternative. It's not as convenient. It has more risks associated with it, like the volatility you're talking about. But on the other hand, at least you'll have access to something, right? Whereas if all the banks turn around and say, you don't have a bank account anymore, I don't know what I would do. I mean, my business would collapse if the banks shut down the account. And I'm working in crypto, and I do have some clients who pay me in crypto. But ultimately, I have to get it off the blockchain and in through an exchange into euros so that I can actually buy food and pay my mortgage and put petrol in my car, right? Mm-hmm. So that's why we're not there yet. We're not in a situation where there is a fully parallel version. It's still locked in niches in various areas, but it does work for me. You know, I can get paid in Tether or Bitcoin, and I can leave it sitting there until I need it and then convert it into euros if I actually have to buy something with it, that where there's no vendor who will sell it to me in cryptocurrency. And petrol stations don't yet accept Bitcoin.
Yeah. And I think that they will for sure, I think, in the future. Mm. But, you know, that's whenever the game changes. As of right now, it's just stored value. Like you're saying, it's not, you can't really just go to the store and say, I'm going to buy this newspaper. Here's 0.00000 Bitcoin. However, you just never know. There could be some rogue entrepreneurs and businesses that start to take it, and maybe they are popping up. It's just not mainstream yet. Now,
there's a lot of work gone into this. Having mobile phone apps that allow you to make there's a thing in Bitcoin called the Lightning Network, because the transactions are a bit too expensive to buy a coffee. They can be tens of dollars, which is great if you're transferring $10 billion. Right. Then a $10 fee for transferring $10 billion as opposed to the 0.5 or 1% that you might be paying in the conventional system. $5 or $10 fee, not so good when you're buying a coffee. But Lightning Network does allow you to transfer smaller amounts. Then it sort of sits above the Bitcoin blockchain as a sort of another layer. It's called a layer two. It's faster and cheaper. It's not quite as decentralized. But it's the trade-off you make. And then if you want to go back to being secure again, you move everything into the lower level. That's kind of like changing your gold for cash and then changing your cash back to gold afterwards.
So to get started, and maybe you do talk about this, I'd love to talk about the parable of the panicking cryptocurrency owner, because that might be relevant to our audience. But how do people get started? You just brought up, I've never heard of the Lightning. Is it the Lightning Exchange or the Lightning Network?
It's called the Lightning Network. It's not quite a blockchain, but it uses some clever mathematics to allow peer-to-peer small transactions, which are kind of backed by Bitcoin. So you're locking some Bitcoin up, and it's allowing you to send representations of. It's like going into a casino and handing over a suitcase of money, and they give you casino chips. Now you gamble with the chips, and at the end you rack up what you have left, and you can convert it back to dollars. So the Lightning Network works like, and it's sort of easier in a casino to be tossing chips on the table than grubby $100 bills and quarters and nickels and things like that, right? So that's one of the reasons they do it. But I mean, another reason, of course, is that it encourages people to gamble more than they would if they saw that they were putting real dollars down. But that aside, that's where the analogy breaks down. It kind of works like that. And it's just one of hundreds of things that are going on. And I don't know which one's going to be successful, which ones are going to get adopted and become mainstream, and which ones are going to die a sad, lonely death. But it's very exciting. There's so much going on. And because crypto and blockchain are primarily at the moment concerned with representations of money, as startups go, it's actually relatively easy to get funding for these things if you've got the right connections. So there's a lot of people are sitting on a lot of profits that they've made, and they're wondering what to do with it. And so many of them think, oh, I'll invest it in developing these systems further. So there's been a lot of motivation to move things forward very rapidly.
So the average person out there listening is potentially wanting to get involved. Where would you recommend them to get started? Or is there I have accounts with MetaMask. I'm sure you've heard of these.
Mm-hmm.
So I've bought a few NFTs just to play around with them. I think they're exciting, but you know, these to me, it's so early that I'm just kind of dipping my toe in the water. Now, I'm not putting a ton of money. I bought my first little bit of Bitcoin back in 2018 accidentally. client had one of those MLMs, and it was all based off of this thing called Bitcoin. And I was like, what the hell is that? I'll put in a couple $100 and, you know, a year later, I'm like, well, I got a little bit of Bitcoin. That's cool. It's worth some money, you know, not much, but it was worth something. And I started to just learn more because I was reaping the rewards. And so I got into crypto a little bit. I started getting the MetaMask accounts and all kinds of other things. But really, to me, it's I only pay attention when I pay. I guess that's the best way to put it. So what would you say for the average person out there listening or reading your book? Here's how to get started so you learn this game, because it will be a game you will want to be great at 10 years from now.
Right. So I think the thing is, firstly, there are sort of two sides. There's the crypto speculating investing side. And that's something that I really don't feel qualified to comment on. I'm a lousy investor. The only thing I've ever really made a profit on was when I bought one Tesla share, because I thought it would be funny to be able to tell people I owned a Tesla. And that was back in 2013.
What is it worth? Do you still have that?
Actually, I sold it about a month ago. It split. The joke ended because they had a 5-for-1 split and then a 3-for-1 split. Suddenly I had 15 Teslas, right?
Great work on that one.
Yeah. So, and I think I spent $80 on it. So, and then in the end, I had 15 times, it was like 3,000. But yeah. I mean, when I buy shares, I make a loss. That's why I'm not. I don't
at least
trade.
You're honest about it, though.
Yeah. And so I've done okay in crypto, not as well as I should have because I'm such a lousy investor. But, you know, I got in early enough and I held on to some. So it hasn't allowed me to retire, but it certainly helped with the mortgage.
Yeah, I'm a buy and hold guy with crypto. Yeah, it's just I see Bitcoin go up and I'm like, ah, that's cool. Even if I had 5 Bitcoin, I wouldn't sell it right now. I'm just going to hang on to it, right? That's the way I look at it.
If you don't need it and you got some sitting there, I'd say, yeah, just forget about it. But make sure you remember it when you're retiring, at least.
Good point.
And then you need to start thinking about strategies to make sure that you don't forget where you put your private keys or your seed phrase, or maybe split it up and share it with people. There's loads of articles out there. I mean, I think really you need to, there's sort of there's a technical drive behind it. And then there's a sort of political and sociological drive behind it. And my book covers both of those. What it doesn't go into is what token you should buy this week, because I haven't got a clue. And really anybody who's telling you that they have a clue is probably looking to use you for what they call exit liquidity. Mm-hmm. So at the point that you find out that a coin is going to go up, it's probably actually peaked, and you're going to be providing the money that allows the earlier people to make a profit.
Great point. I've seen that already many times. Mm,
yeah. I do actually have another book called Evil Tokenomics. It's published under a pseudonym because I wrote it as a story where a master criminal is explaining how he scams everybody. It's really short. It's only 60 pages. So you can read it in a wet afternoon on a Sunday. And it covers all the tricks that these people use to con you into thinking that you're going to make a profit and they walk off with the money. Mm-hmm. But because I can comment on how you can fail, I just can't comment on how you can succeed.
So, you know the red flags to look out for, that's all.
Yeah, exactly. So my book is more about kind of how does the technology fulfill the sociological and philosophical and political promise that cryptocurrencies make? I think we're still in the early days. It's like if we drew a comparison with, say, the car industry, back when cars were first invented, you had to be rich to own a car. Mm-hmm. You know, they were bought by aristocrats who tinkered with them as a hobby. So they were like driving around Europe in the late 1800s in cars that would break down all the time. And the person who bought them was very wealthy, and they actually had a toolbox in the back and they enjoyed working with it. It was a hobby. And then eventually it kind of reached a mass market through things like Ford and, you know, the assembly line stopped making cheap, affordable, reliable cars, relatively speaking. And when I say reliable, I mean, they were nowhere near as reliable. Even in the 70s, I remember my parents had an English car, and we used to joke that English cars are brilliant. They will start every time as long as it's not raining. So we're kind of in I think we're leaving that kind of only people who are enthusiasts and want to get their hands dirty. Things like exchange traded funds appearing for Bitcoin. So you don't have to be that engineer, with spanners and a socket wrench and grease under your fingernails to get involved anymore. But like a lot of these things, it helps to have a bit of an understanding. Going back to the car parallel, when my wife gets in the car and she can't start it, she has no idea what to do. And it could be something as simple as we're out of fuel and she won't notice, or that, the battery's flat or something. Whereas I know enough about a car engine, I'm not a mechanic, but I know enough to kind of fix the basic stuff. Is it the battery? Are we out of fuel? Is that noise because the oil's leaked out? So I know something about car engines, but I'm not an engine expert. And I think we're at that sort of stage where you need to have a kind of a basic understanding of what's going on, so you're not flailing around in the dark. And then 10 years, 15 years from now, there'll be like modern cars where you don't know what's under the engine. In fact, doesn't help you because it's so, I don't know if you've seen what modern car engines look like, but
I was about to buy an electric dirt bike. I'm so worried about doing it because if something goes wrong, it's like, all right, I have no idea. It's got to go back to the shop. It's 2 hours away, right?
Yeah, it's like a sealed unit, I mean, my first motorbike was a Honda H100, and I actually had to assemble it because I bought it in boxes. And so by the end of it...
A little bit different nowadays, you're right.
Yeah, and now when you look at an engine, it's just the whole thing is sort of sealed, and there's like there's no space left anymore. It's just everything is so crammed, and I think that's what will happen with... the equivalent of that will happen with blockchain. I mean, it's already at the point where I can't keep track of it all. I lost track of... back in 2018, I felt like I knew pretty much everything that was going on, 2017. Now there's just so much that you have to kind of specialize. So what
industries do you think will be hit the most as the society, whether it's the United States or just worldwide, starts to adopt it? In my opinion, it's going to be agents, right? I'm just thinking individuals who are out there selling houses. The agents will be cut out, right? They're the first ones, in my opinion. I mean, the blockchain obviously is going to hurt a lot of industries, I think, and cut a lot of people out. It's going to obviously create new industries. So who is the one out there that might get hurt the most?
Well, I'm not sure it's going to harm jobs in that way. And yeah, people are going to have to move into offering different services. If your job is to extract value from a transaction system purely because you're sitting on the only bridge across the river, right? Then it makes sense to me to say, well, this bridge should be a public good.
Credit card companies will get hurt, in my opinion.
Yeah. So indeed. So those are the ones that will go. But they will, presumably, they will move on to other things. So it'll be kind of, well, maybe they'll actually do something useful. Credit card companies already offer things like insurance, and assistance. So, I mean, that's why when I go on holiday, I use a credit card because it's kind of got guarantees. My luggage is covered. They've got a number I can call if I hit a problem, like my card is swallowed by the machine. Those services, I think, are valuable. But when they're just taking 2.5% just purely for the privilege of owning the monopoly, then I think that's wrong. And I think it's good to see that go. I mean, I think the more interesting one is going to see how they affect global economies. You know, there are countries that have a strong position because their currency is considered important.
That could scare the governments too. You're right about that, right? Mm-hmm. They're losing control, which could turn into, and this happens every time there's a major change, wars, right? You could see it happen.
It's worrying. I mean, I'm not one of these people who's sitting at the sidelines hoping that the USA goes the way of the Roman Empire. I know there are people out there who would like to see America do badly. I'm not one of them. I lived in Madison, Wisconsin for a year. So I've experienced the cold version of the American dream. And I still remember the 80s where America was the country that everybody wanted to go and live in. That was kind of, I still feel that was sort of in some ways peak America, just from a cultural point of view,
the way it looked from. Yeah, the 80s, yeah. Right? It was prime time, I think, in the 80s with Reagan years. And you're right, though. Yeah. I think the writing's on the wall. We're looking more and more like the Roman Empire. We're starting to have this decline based off of just hitting our comfort zone, people getting a little bit easier they're getting lazier. And then it's also an easier lifestyle, which does create laziness, but also the corruption in the government. It's starting to happen more. And very much like the Romans, the printing of money getting out of control.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does have a number of disturbing parallels. I mean, I do think that the government corruption is the one that I would worry about the most. And that is something that in the 80s and even the 90s, there was a certain level of embarrassment if they got caught. That seems to have disappeared. It's almost completely. Like it's taken for granted now that, oh, yeah, so what, I did that. You know, I'll apologize and then I'll go back and do it again. So that I do find disturbing, and I do think it's the kind of marker of the end, and then something radical and new has to come along. But it's not the first time you have these cycles. I mean, you know, America got through the Civil War, for example. So it was awful, but you know, the country came out stronger. So I'm not that I'm wishing a civil war on you again.
You're getting close. I mean, you're starting to see how easily one can be set off with all this corruption. It's almost as if people are living in two different worlds, is the way I look at it. And and I think, and maybe this is what I've seen because I'm in these circles, I'm seeing individuals grasp onto the blockchain and crypto and all that because they see what's coming down the road. And if you don't adopt at least this independent thought, right, this belief that, you know, there is corruption, and I'm going to take control of my finances, my health, my my freedom. I'm going to control it as much as possible. You're basically, if you don't do that, you're going into this herd of sheep, and you're going off the cliff. So we're living in two different worlds, and I think the people who are waking up are adopting blockchain, crypto, entrepreneurship, freedom in general. And that scares the powers that be. And I think it's a great time to be alive, but scary if you're not awake yet.
That's that saying, isn't there? That may you live in interesting times. And the interesting times do seem to be accelerating. So
no doubt.
But yeah.
So one last question. When it comes to blockchain, if there's any takeaway from after they pick up your book, by the way, guys, the book is called Move Over Brokers. Here Comes the Blockchain. If there's one takeaway that you want your readers to have, what is it?
I think it's about understanding that there's more than one way to do things. I think one of the problems we have is that, and this is like a really global thought, I realize that, but we tend to get locked into, you know, of course, only the government should print money. And of course, we need banks. And of course, you know, the banks should get a cut for the service that they provide. We don't think about these things deeply enough. And I know that I'm guilty of that with money, that money is a really classic example of it. When you're a kid, you learn that a dollar bill or a nickel or whatever gets you a candy or a soda or something like that. And you think of it in this very naive term, these terms. When you actually start digging into the history of money and how it came about and how it's controlled now and who makes it and how the decisions made how much there should be. You know, we get all this stuff like, oh, they've printed more money or inflation is this. And we just kind of grumble about it and go, yeah, this is bad. Things are getting more expensive. And but most people don't understand the systems that are in place to enable all of this, how it works. And therefore, they don't have the option to propose an alternate system. It's kind of like living in a monarchy under a king who's got divine right, absolute power, and you're just a serf. And you, who am I to question the aristocracy and the laws? And that's what it used to be like in the Middle Ages. And now with blockchain and crypto, we're realizing that we've been living in a similar kind of feudal system, that we haven't been able to question these things because we haven't known what questions to ask. Mm-hmm. And so that to me is the key thing, is it when you start seeing that there are other alternatives and that they are feasible, that then opens up all sorts of possible futures that we couldn't otherwise consider. So that's the, and it does sound a bit sort of evangelizing, I suppose, but that's, I think, the most valuable thing that's come out of it for me. The world looks very, very different to me than it did 15 years ago before blockchain, because a whole bunch of things that I just took for granted, it turns out there's there's a little man behind the green curtain, you know, pulling the levers.
Well, you know, and I think any type of financial literacy is good because you start to wake up to the Federal Reserve and why it was created and how it works. So think about this. The Federal Reserve, it doesn't work for the government. It's this private institution, creates the money, right? Mm-hmm. Creates this money out of thin air, by the way. And that money that's created out of thin air pretty much controls lending, banks, how people do business, the economy. Incredible how much power they have. Mm-hmm. However, they're sitting there and they say to themselves, wait a second, you see this group of people over there? We can't control them because they're not using the money that we're printing. Uh-oh, something has to be done about this. So I would think that those who have their finger on the switch have to be worried about this. And that means they're going to have to make adjustments to control this. But it is pretty wild to see that we are at this time in history that we're seeing the very beginning of a new currency. And the reason why people believe in a dollar bill, or I don't know what the currency is in Finland. What is it? What do you guys use?
Euro.
Okay. Euro.
Backed by the European Central Bank.
By the European Central Bank. But the reason why people believe in it is because other people believe in it. All right. So it's worth five bucks. All right. So that's $5. The moment that belief in the dollar starts to decrease to such a high rate, it's like that's whenever you start to see a total destruction of the economy.
Oh, it's chaos. We've got plenty of historical examples of countries collapsing due to
no belief. Yeah. So the moment individuals lose belief in their currency, it's over. And I'm starting to see it happen more and more. Mm. And just imagine, what if there's that other switch where people start to believe in crypto, in the blockchain more and more? The value of it is going to expand drastically. And we are here to see it, man. The genesis. This is so exciting to be alive at this time. I'm so glad I was born prior to the internet age because I was able to see life before and after. And wow. What a time to be alive.
Now you're getting to see it again. And with the internet, I made a mistake. I saw a web browser in 1994 and I thought, well, this is rubbish.
Me too.
Because it didn't look very good, right? I mean, it's just like a gray page with a picture of a guy in the maths department. And he's like, you know, hi, I'm John Brown. I'm a mathematician. Here are some of my friends. And then like links to other identical looking pages with other identical looking mathematicians. And I thought, what's the point of this? And now I look back and I'm like, oh, you know, I was working for a dot-com company in 1999. It's like, how could I have missed that in 94? So I was kind of, that's why I stuck with blockchain, is because I had the same feeling in the early days. It's like, it looks fascinating, but is it really going to do this? And now we have, you know, notable financial institutions who are putting money into it and providing services around it. Some people see that as a bad thing. I mean, I think it's inevitable.
It's inevitable.
There's money to be made, then these banks will move into it. The difference is that you can opt out of using a bank, right? So the thing is, you can decide, okay, I'm going to buy real Bitcoin and hold them myself. It's got a lot of parallels with gold in that respect. If it's too inconvenient to have gold bars in your cupboard, then you can buy, you know, exchange traded fund gold. And then you've got the exposure to the value of it without actually having to look after the stuff. But what you have with Bitcoin unusually is that you could get the real Bitcoin sent to you in an instant. It's not a matter of you turning up in a car and getting them to fish, you know, this heavy metal out of a vault and hand it to you and needing armored trucks and stuff like that. It can be sent to you like an email.
Yep.
So that's remarkable. And that means you can actually take ownership of it again in a way that most of us don't own our money. It's in the bank, which means it's not really ours. They say they're looking after it. Actually, what they're doing is they're saying that they may give it to you when you ask for it.
That's right. Yeah.
Unless it's a bank holiday or the systems are down or you're buying the wrong thing or they suspect that you're a criminal, right?
Yeah. So if you have to over $10,000 in the bank and you go to the bank today and try to get it out, they're going to laugh at you. Oh, we'll get it to you. Might be a day or two, right? The world is
Can
changing.
You even do that? I mean, in Europe, I think it's illegal now to have financial transactions over a certain number of euros. It's like you're not allowed to. You can't go and buy a 5,000 euro car in cash. It's
amazing.
Cash is meant for buying coffee and cake, That's it.
This world is changing so fast that speed and convenience will always win. And if you think about it, crypto, the blockchain, all that is built upon speed and convenience. And that's why it's so, I think it's such a sure bet that in the future, it's going to be part of our daily life.
Once they get the interfaces working, right, and they make it idiot-proof, or at least foolproof, maybe not, you know.
There'll still be idiots out there, yeah.
Yeah. Whenever you make it foolproof, an idiot finds a way to break it. That's a testing statement.
Give it to an idiot. They'll figure out a way to break
it. Well, that's actually, I find it funny, having been in computer software testing, and a lot of what I had to do for my job was act like an idiot, right? Do the thing.
What would I do?
Nobody would. What's the stupidest thing I can do with this system? That the developer won't have thought of, because he'll think nobody would be that stupid. That's where all the bugs are. But they're getting this stuff ironed out in blockchain, and it's getting more usable all the time, and people are getting more familiar with it, right? So, and the terminology is sort of leaching into the general way we speak about things. Oh my God, you remember the internet when they used to talk about it as the information superhighway?
Yeah, right.
Right? And we're going, we were trying to work out the language and the metaphors and stuff like that. And eventually you don't even need the metaphors because everybody knows what it is. So blockchain and crypto is going through that too.
That's right. The World Wide Web, the AOL.com, all of that was existence back in the day. Now it's nothing. So anyways, I have to run. The book, guys, is called Move Over Brokers. Here Comes the Blockchain. Pick it up today. You really do want to understand this because it will help you become more financially literate, probably make better decisions financially now and in future. And then therefore, you know, if you put this together the right way, you could break those generational curses. And that's what all of our Million Dollar Circle members are doing. So guys, pick up his book, Dr. Care Finlow Bates. It's been an honor to talk with you, sir. You're a very smart man, and you're a punk rock guy. So I like you more and more the more I get to know you.
Okay. It's been wonderful to be here. Thanks for giving me the opportunity.
So check out his book, guys. Remember, a $1 million book will lead to a $1 million life. Right on.